Welcome back to Exploring Boys Education, a regular podcast produced by IBSC for leaders and educators in boys' schools around the world. I'm your host, Bruce Collins. Later in this episode, we'll explore a crucial aspect of boys' learning, that of their well-being, and how we might think about actively caring for boys. However, before we connect with our guests from the Wellbeing Distillery, it's great to have IBSC Executive Director Tom Batty back from his IBSC travels to Canada, South Africa, and Australia. Like you, I'm eager to hear from Tom as he shares his travelling insights and some coalition news in the IBSC newsreel.
Thank you, Bruce, and welcome to all dialing in from across the globe for this podcast. Wherever it reaches you, on behalf of IBSC, I send a big thank you for all you do in sharing your knowledge and for your willingness to join with others to explore how we can better serve the boys in our care. Over the past few weeks, I've had privilege to immerse myself in some of the great work being done by IBSC schools, researching, responding to, and communicating the need for better care for boys and the great part boys' schools play in advancing this cause. At the end of February, I joined Richard Reeves and Michael Reichert on a panel at Crescent School Toronto, considering the theme, There's Never Been Greater Need, the value of a boys' school education, as part of the Crescent Men of Character Education series. Early March took me to the beautiful land of South Africa, where Bruce arranged for me to present at a number of schools before joining what was a truly remarkable IBSC Southern African Regional Conference. It was themed Listening Loudly, Learning to Listen to the Quieter Voices in Boys' Schools, and it was hosted in the stunning campus of Hilton College in KwaZulu-Natal. Memorable experience for all. It was then off to Hales School in Perth, Western Australia, where media events and engagements with staff surrounded a Hale community forum themed Boys to Men in a Changing World, Challenges, Strategies, and Why It Matters, at which I joined Hale Headmaster, Dean DeLauro, developmental paediatrician, Dr. Nikki Panatidis, and AFL footballer Tom Barras on a panel expertly mustered by media presenter and advisor Miriam Borthwick. All were great events highlighting the challenges facing boys and the great work being done by the leaders and staff of our schools to give boys the very best opportunities to flourish and serve. Right, back to the here and now. Joining Bruce in this episode are David Bott and Justin Robinson from the Wellbeing Distillery. And I'd like to thank Headmaster of Hales School, Dean DeLauro, for introducing David and Justin to Bruce. In a moment, David and Justin will shed light on why every interaction at school is a learning opportunity and an opening to nurture boys' wellbeing, and how educators can create a more supportive environment for boys. But before Bruce speaks with David and Justin, I'd like to highlight some IBSC news items. If you're looking to enhance your skills as an educator of boys, consider joining one of our three online classes starting on the 5th of April. Visit the IBSC website for more information to register and prepare to learn. On the 7th of May, the IBSC Empowering Excellence in Boys' Schools virtual event will take place. This is specifically designed for directors of professional development in IBSC member schools. Featuring a panel from IBSC member schools, explore initiatives that upskill teachers new to boys' schools and discover programs that support middle leaders. Excellence across the breadth of school offering is a hot topic, so here's a chance to get ahead of the wave. Lastly, the IBSC annual conference at Harrow is just around the corner. Early bird registration closes on the 16th of April, So now's the time to secure your spot and make sure you have a place to listen, learn, laugh, and share in North London. Just visit the website to register. Now, it's back to Bruce and his guests from the Wellbeing Distillery, Justin and David. Thanks to both of you for sharing your insights on how boys' schools can better care for boys.
It's just wonderful again to connect with Justin Robinson and David Bott from the Wellbeing Distillery. We've had one or two conversations before this, and I've just been so inspired by both of you and your insights and the work you do around well-being in schools. And so I'm very excited about this conversation because so many of our members are talking about the same thing. And I think that the insight and experience both of you bring is going to have huge impact in both the lives of our listeners, but also I think in the lives of the boys that they teach. But before we dive into this conversation, maybe Justin, we can start with you and just give us a brief introduction to who Justin Robinson is and how you got into this work with the Wellbeing Distillery.
Thank you, Bruce, and lovely to be here and to be talking to the audience, an audience of passionate educators involved closely in boys' education. My passion, my dad was a teacher, and I think that's why I chose to be a teacher. My favourite teacher was my maths teacher, Mr. Franken, and that inspired me to be a maths teacher. And as I went through the years of teaching, and more than 25 years of teaching, I had roles as a head of year, a head of house, a head of boarding, and very much it was the pastoral care roles that very much resonated with me. I love the maths and the phys ed teaching, don't get me wrong, but supporting a young person and their families and connecting and helping a group of students, whether a year level of 150 year seven boys at Trinity Grammar, whether 65 in a boarding house at Geelong Grammar, you know, supporting and building a sense of team and a sense of connection and unity was very important and powerful to me. And I so happened to be at Geelong Grammar School when Geelong Grammar School embarked on implementing a whole school approach to wellbeing, positive psychology, then known as positive education. I was a head of house at the time. The opportunity they needed a head of the positive education department, I put both hands up and said, if there's any chance that I could do that, that'd be great. And from there became the Institute of Positive Education, 8 years in that role as the director, and then the last couple of years now pioneering our work with the Wellbeing Distillery, taking everything we've learnt from years of supporting other schools, supporting students, supporting communities, to prioritise wellbeing. So that's a little bit about me, Bruce.
Justin, I love how you mentioned in your first part of your introduction, you mentioned your maths teacher, and that just resonates with me because we often talk, and I'm sure you're aware of this, in the world of boys' education, we talk about boys learning teachers before subjects and how relationship is the one of the primary drivers of success for boys. And so it's amazing for me how you kind of mention your maths teacher, he still sticks in your mind. David, what about you? How did you sort of get into this role and being part of the work that you and Justin do together?
Yeah, thanks, Bruce, and thanks for the opportunity to be on the podcast with you today. I never had an amazing maths teacher. I wish I did, but I didn't. And my dad wasn't an educator at all, so I can't really steal too much of Justin's thunder or share too many stories there, although my mum is a career educator, so it sort of is in my family a little bit as well. But I've always been fascinated by outstanding teaching. You know, I'm not so interested in the large studies that look at, on average, what are the most impactful teaching strategies or how can we best support students. I'm really interested in the outliers, the teachers that are amazing, that are incredible. Justin's maths teacher, what was it about him that was Mr. Franklin that was different from normal teachers? And so I've always been fascinated by that. And I think probably because my mum grew up, you know, around outstanding education. educators as well, and so we had a fascination there. So I wrote a book 10 years ago about the best teachers in the world, and what we accidentally discovered when we interviewed the USA Teacher of the Year, Australian Teacher of the Year, New Zealand Teacher of the Year, was that the best teachers in the world fundamentally do well-being education. That's kind of their secret sauce, is that they connect with students at a different level. They're able to inspire, engage students at a different level. They're able to cause kind of bravery in their classrooms more than any other teacher. And so I stumbled on this field through the recognition that outstanding teaching is fundamentally based in outstanding well-being education. And so my journey began there. I studied to be completed my undergraduate course in psychology, postgrad training as a psych, and then kind of entered this field of well-being education, which is the blend of education and well-being science.
I'm interested, David, you mentioned the whole idea of well-being science, and I know that a lot of the work that Justin, you and David do is focused on the fundamental principles of well-being science. And I suppose that's a very broad topic, but, educators might think, well, wow, I don't have time to dive into all of that. But what are some of those fundamental principles that you feel would be good for educators to know?
It's a great question. And I'd just love to preface what I'm about to say by, again, recognizing the fact that really good teachers, great teachers, outstanding teachers do this anyway. They do this intuitively, this well-being education work. They have this gut feel, this kind of experience that drives their practice, that, they're very good at it intuitively. So it kind of is exciting and not as daunting as it might seem initially, Bruce, but just let me give you one example of kind of the fundamentals. And there was a large study by the OECD a couple of years ago, looking at PISA data, that found that students who report that they feel like an outsider at school score 22 points lower in average in science compared to students who feel that they belong. So one of the most fundamental elements of this work is creating a sense of belonging and connection. And now, none of that sounds kind of radical, but when you recognize that there's a 22 out of 100, 22% increase in science scores, middle school kids, when they feel they belong, you start to recognize, wow, there's some things we can do even better to elevate the capacity of a child to feel they're connected to a teacher. And so that's an example of a principle that we kind of are extracting and then trying to distill strategies and evidence from.
That sense of belonging is really key, particularly probably one of the greatest drivers of academic achievements. Is that sense of belonging.
Another 2019 really large meta-analysis found that when it combined data from 82 different studies, huge study across 20 years, found that students who belong or feel that they belong, they not only learn better, but they also perform better, they feel better, and they behave better. So fundamentally, this concept, as you're mentioning, Bruce, about belonging, it's not just a nice thing that we want our boys to feel nice and comfortable. Partly it's that. And belonging in this drives performance and it drives learning and it drives behavior. And so that's just one element. Belongingness is just one element of relationships. But it is so fundamental. And this is why, we're interested, of course, in learning science and pedagogy, but actually fundamentally, we've got to get this well-being stuff right first, because it supercharges and catalyzes the rest of the growth that's possible for students inside of schools.
Yeah, the foundation essentially, yeah, isn't
correct.
It?
I was going to add, Bruce, the principle that I think was maybe understood, but the simplicity of teachers remembering that well-being is a shared responsibility is particularly powerful. And we kind of know that as parents, that our children's well-being is a shared responsibility. We kind of need to try to nurture their well-being and support and help them to feel safe in their environment. And they've got things to do as well. And the young people in our classrooms, and often it's the ones who are the most challenging students, the most difficult students. And that's your responsibility as a teacher to endeavor to work extra hard there, not just on helping them understand their mathematics, vitally important, Bruce, but also to help them feel safe. And not just connected to you as the teacher, but connected to their colleagues, their fellow peers, and so on. So this idea that as a teacher, when you've got a student who's quiet or a student who's disengaged, I've got a shared responsibility here with this student to try to nurture and foster their well-being so, as we say, we can be ready for learning. But the other side of the shared responsibility says to the school environment, therefore, there are skills and knowledge we can provide to these young boys, you know, in a proactive way to give them a language, the language of character strengths, the language of resilience and cognitive thinking traps and putting things in perspective and on the list kind of goes, providing skills and knowledge, just like we provide skills and knowledge in mathematics, to enable social, emotional learning skills or well-being skills, so then they can do their part in this shared responsibility.
Susan David writes about emotional granularity, and the more words we give, in this case to boys, to give voice to what they are feeling, the easier it becomes for them to process how they experience the world. And so as we talk about building those supportive well-being environments for boys in schools, what are some of the strategies you might recommend for school leaders? And then I think there's a knock on there for teachers, and possibly also because we know schools are communities, that parents are part of that as well. How might we think about collaboratively supporting boys' well-being with a particular focus on the challenges that boys face in this day and age?
Bruce, one thing I just wanted to draw on that you've mentioned a couple of times, the importance of proactiveness and getting in early. And just to acknowledge how challenging that is. Sometimes in our work with well-being in education and in schools, I'm envious of the school counsellor who has a student arriving to them kind of with their hand up, I need some help. What are your ideas here? Because this is not working for me. When you go proactively en masse to students, the majority of students, and you know, by definition, they have to be saying, I'm okay, because you went there proactively. So when they're okay, boys in particular possibly are not so interested in learning mindfulness for one day. Maybe when I'm 20, that might be helpful, or maybe I need to learn this skill about resilience or relationships and so on later on. So we must as well, in trying to the challenge of being proactive, is still ensuring it makes sense to their real life and their current situation and their current experiences, and be wary that me in my mid-50s, whilst I still might feel like a teenager at times, to that 15-year-old boy, I'm a long way from understanding their life, and how we try to ensure that the information, the skills and the knowledge we're passing on are equipping them for today as well as for tomorrow. To then come to the idea of some strategies for teachers and school leaders, two that I would like to, you know, that come to mind. The first is this idea of knowing them beyond the classroom. You know, how can you know your students beyond the four walls of the classroom, beyond your subject? How can school leaders get to know their students as well as possible? And of course, depending on the size of the school and so on, it's not, you know, particularly easy, but there are skillful ways and efficient and effective ways of helping those young people realize that they are known and have been seen and can be heard if they'd like to with their voice. And the second one is this idea of remembering that well-being is both taught and caught. And for boys, certainly as much of, if not more of, they will catch well-being by watching the way that the teacher is self-regulated, the way that the leader's language that they use, the way they express their gratitude, the way they express their common humanity of the challenges they're facing. And so in some ways, the implicit well-being messages from the role modeling of healthy adults trying to do their best, trying to nurture and care for a community, is a very powerful way of enabling a safe, caring community.
It just strikes me as so important. I think of how busy boys' schools are, and I think so often when people approach wellness in busy environments, they often think, well, how do we make this less busy? And maybe there is part of evaluating how busy your space is, but it seems to me that that on its own isn't going to make a huge impact. It's really about the skills that we build. And I love this idea of modeling. And I even think for older folk like us who've been in school environments to be able to model our own approach to well-being and to be able to speak freely about how we approach some of the struggles we face, it seems to be a powerful lever to help boys catch, like you say, this idea that well-being is important.
My little addition to that, because I completely agree, Bruce, and this is the way I think about it as well. When you read the literature, what you see in young boys in kind of 15 to 24 age group in Australia, in the US, but also internationally around the world, UK, is that we see an elevated level of risk of perpetrating and experiencing aggression and violence, high rates of conduct disorder in boys, high rates of accidental death, and significantly higher rates of self-harm in young men compared to older men or women. So we have this really high risk group of young humans that we're supporting, right, that have all these elevated risks. But we also see in that same age group an elevated or higher, quite high level of subjective well-being and satisfaction with life. So when you ask these boys, how do you feel life's going? They'll tell you they're okay. In fact, they score higher on subjective well-being than girls do. And they'll tell you their well-being's fine, despite the fact that the risk factors associated with ill-being are much higher. And this is the kind of fundamental problem, I think, is that boys are struggling, but they don't know they're struggling. Boys are living with these really high risks that they're not even aware of the risk. And a lot of that is because we haven't, as a modern society, really addressed this concept of, you know, denial of vulnerability, denial of emotional control, like the kind of this Western idealist masculine kind of value system that's been pervasive for a number of years has kind of created a real tension in young boys where they're really struggling, but they don't know how to articulate it. And this is why I think, as you're saying, Bruce and Justin, that they're having these brave conversations, open conversations, role modeling struggle and challenge, and then providing strategies to manage that in a really open, brave environment is essential for boys' well-being going forward. And that's what we're seeing, you know, that the best kind of well-being education examples around the world in Australian boys' schools, UK, US boys' schools, we see some outstanding examples of opening that opportunity to have that crucial discussion.
So I think two things stick out for me here, and you've mentioned the one right now, David, is this whole idea of the creation of a safe environment. We think of long-term safety in terms of the things that you've mentioned, the risky behaviors. If you've read Richard Reeves's work, men in the US particularly, you know, their propensity to complete suicide is four times higher than that of women. So this whole idea of safety seems so important for me. But also the idea of honesty, being honest with boys and helping them to be honest with themselves. And you say to acknowledge the struggle that they're going through. So as we think about that in a school context, what might the creation of that safe and honest environment for boys look like in a school?
I love the way you phrase that, Bruce, and the honesty is essential. And I think maybe one fundamental shift we're seeing is, and you may have heard it in my language even today, is a shift from kind of creating safe education environments to creating brave education environments where we're not all feeling nice and happy and singing kumbaya all the time because it's safe, but we're actually really stretching ourselves to our limit and learning how to be resilient. And ultimately that is, in terms of the way we think about well-being, we have resilience as the pinnacle asset of well-being. That's our primary job as a parent, as a teacher, as a school, is to develop resilience in young boys and girls, and obviously boys in this setting. And resilience really is the capacity to successfully navigate life. And so that to develop that capacity, the only way to do that is to have conversations around resilience, have conversations around struggle, to open up language and experiences and activities and strategies and tactics that cause boys to be stressed and challenged, and then enable them to learn to cope with the inevitable challenges of life. So our job as educators isn't to create really happy, safe environments. It's to create really brave, resilient environments and really brave, resilient students.
I love how passionately you share that. And I think it is a, you know, it's almost not an either or. It can be an end. Of course, we want safety. And that's not what David's saying. I don't think any of you thought that. But of course, we want bravery and courageous students who are happy to take risks, you know, academic risks and so on. I like the term and that the concept of helping school communities kind of recognize that we connect through our similarities, but that we grow through our differences. And this helps us to not just tolerate difference, or not even just to accept difference, but to embrace difference. That when actually we have difference in our community, and that might be difference because of the different teachers, and it might be different through cultural personalities and all sorts of things, but this is a good thing for you to be unique. We are unique. Like, of course, when, you know, let's say the school starts at year seven and it's the first day of year seven and there's 100 boys coming, and you can imagine the stress and you're just hoping that you meet someone who barracks for the same sporting team as you, or likes the same music, or is wearing the same, you know, runners or shoes as you, or something or other. Because, you know, there's a connection. You also like watching Ted Lasso. And so suddenly you have a little connection there. But then through growing through our differences, when someone introduces you to a different type of music and someone says that I played the tuba and I didn't even know what the tuba was. And, you know, and then this allows you to feel comfortable no matter who you are, whether you're the parent, the teacher, the operational staff member, the school principal, the students, you know, you can be yourself because we've got connections to help us, you know, our similarities, and we're looking for and embracing difference. And so therefore, let's work in this group of colleagues to be stretch ourselves in a brave, you know, challenging learning environment in this period. And then we go to this period, let's also sit in different groups and connect here. And it's not just I've got a friend or a mate at school. I feel known. I feel that I can look others in the eye. I feel that they know who I am and they accept me for who I am.
I'm struck by how important this work is for teachers, and in a similar way, possibly for coaches in the afternoon extracurricular, or if boys are part of the choir, the, you know, the music department, or playing musical instruments. And a little phrase that really struck me in our previous conversations around this, as we were preparing for this podcast, is that phrase that every lesson is a well-being lesson. And our boys, I think, you know, it's wonderful to have someone like you, Justin, in a school who was leading sort of the charge towards creating an environment of well-being or positive education. But as I'm sure you would recognize, whoever's in charge of that role isn't spending necessarily every minute with every boy, where teachers who are on the ground in the classroom, coaches who are on the sports field, those folk are engaging with our boys all the time, and have, as we've mentioned before, curriculum to get through. That's what parents are expecting. And yet, in this conversation, we're essentially saying that every lesson is a well-being lesson. So how can educators and possibly coaches as well effectively incorporate some of the principles and some of the strategies that we've been speaking about into their practices and across different subjects and areas, so that boys are having that well-being experience at sort of every point in their journey through a school day?
If I can jump in first and use David's opening words in the podcast about intentionality, and come back to one of your words you said a little bit ago, Bruce, about busyness. And one of the messages we'd certainly like to give to all teachers out there, our goal in no way, shape or form is for teachers to be busier and to work harder. So the question then, though, we must embrace this tension of, yes, we've got a curriculum and, yes, we've got well-being. We haven't got an answer. We're not taking half of your curriculum away from you and all these sorts of things. And yes, of course, you have to assess work and you have to challenge and differentiate your work. And that's, of course, demanding and challenging. But the question is thinking intentionally even as a starting point. So if knowing a young person's name is vitally important and the first step to connection, then the night before lesson one and lesson two and lesson three, instead of spending another 15 minutes on preparing some curriculum or some content, looking at the photos, memorizing them, testing yourself to kind of, and that's genuine work. That's not, that's me preparing my lesson. One of the tactics we talk about is emotional choreography, where as a teacher, have you, and you probably never even heard of that phrase, but have you thought about the emotional journey of your 50-minute lesson or 75-minute lesson? Have you thought the emotion I want to start with is calm and hence a little one-minute mindfulness practice? Or actually I want to start with joy or humor, and then I want to go here, and then I want to get them curious, and then I want to stump them and get them, then I want them to work in, and then I want to go back to calm. And so, and think about how I'm going to emotionally teach these young people, these boys that need this language, as you said, the importance of the emotional agility, Susan David's work. So having a language, the language of character strengths, the language of emotions, once you have this language and that becomes present and the concept of what you focus on grows, so suddenly you've got a character strength poster up in your room that says gratitude or says kindness, or, and suddenly you're using that word a little bit more in the classroom, or you're noticing and acknowledging it in a student and noticing these positive human qualities and building and fostering them in the classroom.
I think I just add two things, Bruce. One is in terms of every lesson being a wellbeing lesson, that only happens when a school has a very, very clearly defined wellbeing strategy. That's the only way that can happen at scale inside of a school, because every school in the world has great teachers, and most schools in the world have some teachers that are not great. And we can't leave it up to possibility. That's why Justin's so keen on intentionality, right? But we can't have individuals with intentionality. If we really want to shift the needle, we've got to have a school with intentionality. And that starts with a really well-articulated wellbeing strategy that then has a really clear plan around that, that then filters down into every single classroom, so that for that 1,000 hours of classroom experience that a typical child will have in a year, that 1,000 hours, every single one of those hours is enhancing the wellbeing of the child. Because the way the teacher, as Justin said, greets the child, the way that assessment is done, the way that even lighting is designed in a new school environment, the way that the discipline or behavior issues are managed, all of that can be incredibly valuable well-being growth opportunities for a child when it's intentionally crafted through really skillful teaching. And as I said earlier, once you have this strategy and you have this intentionality, the joyous wonder of this work is that we can take great teachers, share strategies and tactics, and it just helps elevate their craft a little bit. They just become a little bit better, a little bit more connected to children and students. So I think that the strategy is essential, and then the kind of shaping of the craft of all teachers through strategies and practical stuff is how every single lesson becomes a wellbeing lesson.
Also, we don't want safe teaching. We want brave teaching. What does brave teaching mean? I've never done a mindfulness. I don't think I've got a voice that can do a deep breathing exercise. Brave teaching, just like you want the students to be brave, I'll give that a try. You know, I've never started with music before. Is that right or wrong? And in our work, we never suggest that things are right or wrong that we know. You're the best practice of you. Well-being is personal. Your classroom is individual to the way that you. But have you got a main large comfy chair in your classroom and other students have got a little plastic chair? Well, is that the message? What would it mean if you had a plastic chair? Is that something you want to consider? What about if you didn't sit down for this lesson? What about if you only sat down for this lesson? What about if you started this way? Be brave in your teaching, because no one's got all the answers. We've still got so much ill being out there. We need brave, courageous, curious teachers trying to nurture safe and brave learning environments.
I'm also mindful of the fact that in a 30, 40-minute conversation. We have covered probably so much, and we haven't been able to dive even under the surface, because I think this work is so important and there is so much to speak about. But I'm so grateful for the angle from which both of you have come in terms of sharing this with us. And so just as we close this part of the conversation, I'd love to hear a little bit more about the Wellbeing Distillery and the role and impact you have as a group, as a company, in enhancing school-wide wellbeing initiatives. And also maybe if there are schools, because I know you work with a number of boys' schools and understand boys' schools, there might be schools that want to get in touch. How might they be able to do that?
Thank you, Bruce. In a nutshell, we hope, like, our tagline is equipping humans for life, predominantly through school settings, is what we're passionate about in the Wellbeing Distillery. We like to listen carefully, distill the science, and then create bespoke kind of understandings and solutions to help schools move forward and to make wellbeing in some ways kind of easier. I hope that makes sense, that term easier, because wellbeing is meant to kind of be easy. It's not meant to be exhausting and draining and annoying, but it can be on occasions. So as a small team of teachers passionate about and experienced in working with schools throughout Australia and internationally, we kind of say, where are you strategically? Would you like some help strategically? Where are you regarding the literacy and the language and the knowledge of wellbeing for your teachers? Is that an area that you would like to just, you know, increase their capacity of knowing about wellbeing science? Then the other kind of, as we move further down the path, we then tell us about the culture and about the stakeholders. Where are the parents at? You know, can we support and assist this in any way? What about then the curriculum? What about measurement and so on? So it's all elements of it, but you can't necessarily do them all at the one time. It's understanding where are your pain points? Where do you want to shift this needle? That's what David said earlier, and that's important to us. So how can we then, you know, work with you to support your culture and your well-being, and how do we measure the impact of it and so on? So that's our work, is trying to energize, equip and empower schools through our experiences with well-being.
You can check us out at thewellbeingdistillery.com, and we're at the Wellbeing Distillery on LinkedIn and on Instagram, or look up Justin or I on LinkedIn as well. We're enjoying having some great conversations with educators around wellbeing on LinkedIn. So please do connect. If you've got questions, if you want us to just give a little bit of advice or share our favorite books, or you need some support in your school, we love this work, Bruce. We don't have all the answers, but we love this work, and we love supporting schools in their pursuit of the wellbeing of their communities. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you to both of you for this conversation. It's been fascinating. I do want to say we have some bonus content as well. So those of you who are involved in boys' boarding schools, please look out for the bonus piece of this conversation, which will be released as a separate add-on to this episode. But for this part of the conversation, Justin and David, just so grateful for what you've shared, and I think you've opened so much up for us in terms of insights into what's important. So thank you.
Thank you, Bruce.
Thanks, Bruce.
As I said, I'm left with the sense that even small changes can make a really big difference for boys' well-being. So I'd encourage you to take some time to reflect on the strategies and principles David and Justin have shared, to consider how you can apply these in your own classrooms and interactions with boys. And don't forget, for our boarding school listeners, there's some fantastic bonus content available now in an extra bonus episode that dives deeper into supporting boys' well-being in residential settings. This has been another episode of Exploring Boys' Education. Thanks for listening. Until next time, keep on championing boys' education.